Yeah, Mr. Noel Horner.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hope you had a good night's rest. I keep wanting to say good morning since I slept in this morning. Certainly have good weather. Hopefully this will keep up throughout the feast, as Mr. Walker mentioned last night. About 44 years ago, when I was about age 19, I was rather perplexed when I observed my father and my mother do something that I thought was rather strange at the time. They packed their suitcases, got in the car, and drove 500 miles for a religious convention. And they did this the next year too. And not only that, but they went to other religious services on what we now call, what I now know are God's holy days. It all seemed rather strange to me, the names, Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and all that. And I later learned, too, that my dad saved 10% of his income for this special religious convention that he attended. And then later I was told that it was called the Feast of Tabernacles, and of course that meant nothing to me. I didn't expect it at that time because I had other objectives in my life than being a part of any church. But within a few years, I would find myself doing the same thing. I went to the same religious convention at the same site they went to and enjoyed it immensely. And so here I am. This is my 42nd Feast of Tabernacles. And here you are. You've planned this for months. You've taken considerable measures to be here. You've saved money so you can meet your expenses here. You've sacrificed financially to be a part of this work that we know is of God. And many of you have taken your vacation time, in part at least, so you can be here. So you've made sacrifices. And so in reflection of all this, I ask this question: what is our reason for being here? I remember a certain gentleman with white hair who used to lead us at the feast. My first site was Big Sandy, Texas. Next year I was a student in college at Big Sandy. But he used to ask, "Why are we here?" And I'm sure many of you will remember that. So indeed, to put it another way, what is the Feast of Tabernacles all about? What's it all about? So I want to give you four things that the feast is. Four things that the feast is. For one thing, this is the feast of the Lord. Let's go back to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, and I'll start in verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." So God says they are my feasts, not the feast of the Jews, but these are my feasts, the feasts of the Lord or the feast of the eternal. Drop down with me to verse 34. "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this 7th month," and that's what this is today, the 15th day of the 7th month of God's calendar, the holy calendar, "the 15th day of this 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Lord." So again, it's important to get the basics down, and of course you've heard these things before, but it's good to refresh ourselves in these very vital points. A feast to the Lord. Then in verse 39, "Also on the 15th day of the 7th month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. So that's the third place here in the 23rd chapter of Leviticus that mentions that these are the feasts of the Lord or to the Lord. Shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, that's today, and on the eighth day a Sabbath rest. So this is important to remember. We are here to observe a commandment of God. Not of men, but of God. Now some say they were done away with the new covenant. And we might ask and do ask, then why is it that the New Testament church kept them? And we do find in the book of Acts that the feast is mentioned. And of course we find that Jesus Christ kept the feast as well when he was in the flesh. You know, if these had been done away, there'd be in the New Testament era of the church, there would have been a tremendous controversy. We see a major controversy over the issue of circumcision when that was done away as a requirement for membership in the church. And so if they had done away with the feasts, you would see a controversy probably even greater than the controversy that erupted over the doing away with the necessity for circumcision. And the same is true with the weekly Sabbath, for that matter, and for unclean meats. If either of those had been done away, well, there would have been a major controversy in the New Testament church. I'll go to Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14, I'll read verses 16 through 19. Here we're looking at future times, the time that we're picturing here. Zechariah 14, 16, it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations, we're talking about those who are left after the day of the Lord and all of the travail that that will bring, those who are left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So we see it observed in the future. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. And if the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So Egypt. And if we see Egypt keeping them, we can be sure that all Gentile nations will keep them, not just Egypt. Now the second thing this is the Feast of Booths. That's B-O-O-T-H-S, not B-O-O-Z-E. Though it's all right to imbibe in moderation. This is the Feast of Booths. Let's go back again to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, verses 42 and 43. Leviticus 23, 42, God said to Israel, you shall dwell in booths, margin says tabernacle, or tabernacles, plural. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, meaning during this time, that your generation may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths, or temporary dwellings. When I brought them out of the land of Egypt, I am the Lord your God. Now what is a booth? Well, as I mentioned, it's a temporary dwelling. The Hebrew is sukkah, S-U-C-C-A or S-U-C-C-O-T-H, and it means tabernacle or temporary dwelling. They made theirs out of boughs of trees. Sometimes in the New Testament, rather in the King James Bible, it is translated booths. At other times, it is translated tabernacles. Same word, though, but sometimes translated one way, sometimes another. We call it the Feast of Tabernacles. And as we notice here in the verse I read to you, Israel lived in tabernacles or booths to commemorate their coming out of Egypt. Now, what meaning can we derive from this? Or what's in this for us in terms of our understanding? Well, one meaning is that we live today in temporary dwellings, that is, this flesh, this earthly body. Let's go to 2 Corinthians. Second Corinthians 5. Second Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 4. For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, and he's speaking of the physical body, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. And he's speaking of the spiritual body that we'll put on at the resurrection. For in this we groan earnestly, desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. Now, the Apostle Paul had gone through many trials in serving as a minister and an apostle, and he looked forward very much to the time when he could be free, in a sense, of the labors of that life that he lived in those days. Verse 3, if indeed having been clothed, we shall not be found naked, for we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed. So he didn't want to necessarily give up life. He wanted a better life, eternal life. Further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. So that's one meaning of the Feast of the Booths, a temporary dwelling, and it teaches us that our bodies are but temporary dwelling places. And so he looked forward to the resurrection. We look forward to the resurrection here as well. We'll hear things about the resurrection, I imagine, perhaps in addition to what I'm saying. And we look forward to that spiritual tabernacle. And so the word booth or tabernacle reminds us of the need for a new body. Now, number three, the third thing that the feast is, the Feast of Ingathering. The Feast of Ingathering. Let's go to Exodus chapter 23. Exodus chapter 23 and verse 16. Let's start in verse 14. It says, three times you shall keep the feast to me in the year. And we know there are three festival seasons. We have the spring season. We have the early harvest season, Feast of Pentecost. And then we have the fall season, which we're in now. And let's drop down to verse 16. Verse 15 talks about the days of unleavened bread. And verse 16 says, and the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, that's Pentecost, which you've sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is at the end of the year when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. So this is the feast of ingathering. The larger part of the harvest was in the autumn. Spiritual meaning of this, spiritual symbolism, the throngs of humanity who will live through the tribulation and live on over into the millennium, in addition to those who are born during the millennium and grow up and mature, they will have opportunity to know God. The great harvest. And then, of course, we know that we will have the last great day, and we'll have messages on that day, the eighth day. I read about that a little bit earlier as to the sanctification of that day. The last great day in which all the uninitiated in God's truth will be able to come to God, will have the blindness removed from their eyes. Satan will be bound, pictured by the Day of Atonement, we know. And all will have opportunity to come. Now, number four, the fourth thing this Feast of Tabernacles is, this is the feast. This is the feast. This is the big one. For us, it's a time to learn, a time to review what we know, which we'll hear more of during these days, the time to review of God's prophecies, God's laws, the time for review of what is expected of a priest and a king, Revelation 5:10, I won't turn there, says, "We shall be priests and kings and shall reign on the earth." So it's very important that we keep our ears open, because we're going to hear a lot of spiritual meat here during this feast. The feast is a time to rejoice. All the feasts are, even the Day of Atonement has a more subdued note of rejoicing perhaps, but it is a time of rejoicing because it's a vital part of God's plan. Let's go to Nehemiah. It's also a time to share, as we're going to see here in Nehemiah. And you shared, many of you, when you sent in your tithe of the second tithe to help finance so others who are less fortunate than you can go to the feast and to help pay for the expenses of the feast, rental of facilities and all of that sort of thing. But in Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 10, this is a Feast of Tabernacles context. Nehemiah 8, verse 10. Then he said to them, "Go your way, eat the fat, and drink the sweet." That means enjoy. Another place you find that the festival tithe or the second tithe is to be spent on whatsoever your soul or whatsoever you desire. Eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. There's the sharing aspect that's brought out. For this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. So we shouldn't be down at the mouth. Hopefully we can leave home problems at home. In many cases, they'll be there when you go back, but hopefully you'll be fortified and strengthened to deal with them a little better. Drop down with me now to verse 12. And all the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions, and rejoice greatly. So they were very exuberant in their opportunity to keep the feast. Rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. Now, there's an aspect of rejoicing we need to keep in mind. You're going to hear the truth preached. As I've mentioned, you're going to hear aspects of God's plan brought out and a review of what we need to be a part of that. So we need to tune in while we're here for the services. We need to listen to the sermonettes and the sermons and have a spiritual feast as well as a physical feast. And we need to be very thankful that we are here. We were once without God in the world, unaware of the knowledge of the truth. God brought us out. The world is still without God. So, brethren, let's indeed have a feast that is top-notch. And let's have a physical as well as a spiritual feast.
I was telling Mr. White before I came up that Mr. Walker forgot to put the microphone back down for us normal people. Good afternoon to all of you, and delightful to see a full house. I don't see a whole lot of empty seats today, which is nice. Hope you're enjoying the front end of the feast. Last night, Mr. Walker went through the normal census to see all of the statistical categories, and it was delightful to see how many of you are here for the first time in Bend. I can tell by the weather forecast that you should have an absolutely delightful feast, and we hope you have the opportunity while you're here to see some of the beauty of the high desert, or if you happen to go just a little bit to the west, the rim of the Cascades. As all of you are aware, obviously by your presence here, we are here to celebrate the most awesome time in all of human history. I'm reminded frequently of the comment in Romans chapter 9 that says the entirety of creation groans in anticipation for the revealing of what is going to take place when the days that you and I are celebrating right now become a reality. I hope every year as you attend and as you keep the feast, it isn't just simply another year's tradition. Last night we could see that there were many in the room that had been here decades. But we hope it's fresh, special, exciting to you each and every year. As you will see as we move into the sermon this afternoon, I'm going to be setting the stage for the front end of the millennium. The course of the Feast of Tabernacles gives those who are giving sermonettes and sermons the opportunity to speak of all facets of this time when it comes. My focus will be more on the front end, literally the time in the cycle that is commensurate with the time of the week that we are meeting right now. In 1925, an advertising executive named Bruce Barton, a son of a Congregationalist minister, wrote one of the most widely recognized religious books of the 20th century. The book is entitled The Man Nobody Knows. The book was Mr. Barton's attempt to reveal Christ to the men of his world, successful men, men of business, men of industry. If you've ever read the book, or if you take the time to read the book, you will come away, having finished the book, understanding that Christ was still unknown to the reader, for who he really was, for what he really stood, and for where he was really going. That really, in one sense, is nothing new. In John chapter 8 and verse 19, Jesus Christ, 2,000 years before Mr. Barton, was talking to men, successful men, men who were leaders, men who were the movers and shakers of his day and his time. And he said to an audience composed of men comparable for his day with the audience of Mr. Barton in 1925, the following words. John chapter 8 and verse 19, he said to them, or they said to him, "Where is your father?" And Jesus answered, "You know neither me nor my father. If you had known me, you would have known my father also." 2,000 years passed between the words of Jesus Christ to this audience and Mr. Barton, but the circumstances were the same regardless of the passage of time. For all the effort expended in the last 2,000 years, the real Christ is still unknown to the world around us, and so is the Father. When these holy days become a reality, when you and I are no longer going to some place in the United States or Canada or elsewhere in the United States to assemble, to commemorate, or look forward to something, but when the day comes that we are actually in the fulfillment of the days that we now picture, we will see a very different setting. a setting, in fact, that is described in Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah chapter 31 is devoted to the restoration of Israel and Judah as they return from captivity at the beginning of the millennium. So the setting of Jeremiah is a setting that is exactly identical to this block of time that we now observe, and actually to this end of it, meaning that the front end, the first day, the beginning of this period. And in Jeremiah chapter 31, one of the things that Christ is going to fulfill in the millennium, and that will be a focal point as the millennium begins, is described in verse 34. He said, "No more shall every man teach his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, says the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquities, and their sins I will remember no more." One of the achievements that God intends to accomplish in bringing these days to fulfillment is to arrive at the place where the entirety of humanity knows God. It is here in Jeremiah 31:34, as we look at the time setting, that God says, for the first time in history, I will be known of all men. I don't know when you're coming to the Feast of Tabernacles, and as I said, the routine nature of it over the years, whether you stop to ponder and to consider how privileged you are. You are among a very small number of people on the face of this earth who can truly, not arrogantly, not haughtily, but simply with candor, say, I know God. I don't know if you realize it is impossible to fully know and understand God without being here and observing and understanding the meaning of these days. Why is the eternal Father in heaven the God nobody knows? And how will the coming of these days, pictured by our observance, change that? Let's begin with a simple question. What does it take to know God? People believe because they can read the stories about God between Genesis and Malachi, and that they can read the stories about Jesus Christ between Matthew and Revelation, that therefore they know them. Frankly, brethren, the Bible has made clear from one of the earliest personalities in the Bible that just because you can read about somebody, just because you can see the stories and read the words, does not mean that you know the individual or the personage. In the book of Job, at the very end of the book, those of you that are familiar with it, Job is assaulted by three of his friends who try to break down his resistance, and they do so in an exercise in futility. God then says, Job, stand up and listen, and I'll challenge you. And when God was finished, Job made this statement in Job chapter 42 and in verse 5. Job said, and here was a man who God had great respect for. And yet, even in this man's case, he said in verse 5, he said, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees. Job said, you know, there's a difference between knowing God and knowing God. There's a difference between saying, oh, yeah, I'm familiar. I know God. And really knowing God. God is the most known about being in the universe. It doesn't mean that people know him. I want you to consider the next comment very carefully. The privilege to know God is given by permission, and it carries conditions. Let me say that again. The privilege to know God is given by permission, and there are conditions. Most of you are familiar with a statement made by Jesus Christ in the book of John. John chapter 6 and in verse 44. Jesus began his conversational point in the previous verse, and in verse 43, Jesus therefore answered and said to them, "Do not murmur among yourselves." And he then made this simple, direct, flat comment. "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day." Jesus Christ said, without equivocation, without elaboration, he simply said, understand something, no one can come unless drawn. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. You sit here by permission. I was listening to Mr. Horner, and I was smiling to myself as he was speaking, because he talked of his mother and father doing what we're doing, and I'm putting it in my own word, the nonsense, and I don't mean that disrespectfully, I mean it just didn't make sense, okay? I mean it in the pure sense of no sense. The days, the names, Feast of Tabernacles, none of it registered. And then as he continued on, he said, in a few years, he was sitting here, and it made full sense. The difference between it not making sense a few years earlier and making sense and being where he wanted to be a few years later was because he had been permitted. He had been invited. He had been drawn. If not, it would still not make sense. Every single person in this room has someone in their blood family line who looks at what they're doing right now and it doesn't make sense to them. Doesn't mean they're antagonistic or they're hostile. It just means it doesn't make sense. You know, this is okay for you, but it's not okay for me. I respect what you do, but there's no drive, no compulsion for me to be there. I'm not going to turn there. It should be well known to many of you. Jesus Christ began speaking in parables in Matthew 13. His disciples said to him, "Why are you doing that?" And his response to them was, "It is given to you to understand the mysteries. It is not given to them." He said very simply to his disciples, "To you it has been given to understand what this is all about, where it is all going, where it's leading, and how it will come to fruition." He said to the audience in general that I am speaking, that has not been given. You've been extended an invitation. And with that invitation comes the opportunity to know God. Every so often you can take a magazine that's devoted to personalities. And you can take a personality that appears on the cover. And the face would be known to everyone. I was going to say everyone in the Western world, because of American media, probably known around the world. And a writer will sit down and in a biographical sense begin to talk about the individual from an intimate sense, what they like to do, what their ambitions are, how they like to spend their private time, the things that they enjoy in life. And all of a sudden, a personality known around the world by face, you could hold up the magazine cover and say, "Oh, well, that's so-and-so." Well, now they begin to probe into their private life and you say, "Oh, you know, from being, for instance, a movie star, from appearing in movies and portraying and acting out characters, you would never know in their private, intimate life what it is they like and they don't like, what they do and they don't do, where they go and they don't go, and who they like to be around and they don't like to be around. God has allowed you into His private life. He's allowed you into His intimate life. He's allowed you in at a level that's not just simply recognition of personality or name. I said there were conditions. We review every single solitary year, for those of you who are baptized members of the Church of God, we review every single solitary year on the night before Christ's crucifixion, the annual Passover service, the words that He shared and the dialogues that He had with His disciples in that final, last opportunity to speak with them before His arrest, His beating, and His crucifixion. In John 14, and it is a nature of our service that we begin in John 13 and we read selected portions from John 13 for the next few chapters through John chapter 17. As is typical with things that are done traditionally, both the reading and the hearing of these can be rote. You can hear the same chapters read over and over again 10, 20, 30 times, and the words become very familiar to the place that you don't stop to think about them. In John 14, the other Judas, not Judas Iscariot, Christ had two disciples with the name Judas. The other Judas asked Christ a profound question. We look at their dialogues as if these fellows were asking very superficial questions and Christ was answering very profoundly. And that's true in some cases, but not in every case. In John 14 and verse 22, it reads as follows. Judas, not Iscariot, said to Him, and this is a question, brethren, that we're pondering right now. He said, Lord, how is it that You will make Yourself known? That's what the word manifest means. Lord, how is it that You will make Yourself known to us and not to the world? How is it that You're going to go about building a relationship of familiarity with us, and yet society, broadly speaking, will not share in that particular relationship? Christ answered him. And the answer that He gave is very easy to gloss over as religious talk. In other words, this is just a part of the rhythm of the religious talk of Christ to His disciples. It'd be a mistake to treat it that way, but let's read it. John 14, Jesus answered and said to him, as soon as his question was over, He said, verse 23, if anyone loves Me, he will keep My word, and My Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. Hard not to know someone who lives with you. You know, it's one thing to read about a personality that lives in London or Paris or New York or Hollywood or somewhere like that. But somebody who lives with you, it's hard not to know them. He says, look, you love Me, you keep My word, and My Father will love you, and we'll come, and we'll make our home with you. Conversely, he who does not love Me does not keep My word, and the word which you hear is not Mine, but the Father's who sent Me. So He said, here's the one side. Here's the other side. The one side says, we'll come and live with you. The other side says, we have no intentions to come and live with you. Let me put what He said, verse 23 and 24 are not hard to understand, but John wrote in his epistles, in a much blunter fashion in some cases than he wrote in his gospel. If you turn, and you might keep your finger where we currently are, and turn back to 1 John chapter 2. The way John spoke in his letters was so direct, so crisp, and so succinct that it is nigh unto impossible to not understand what he's saying. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 3 says, "Now by this we know that we know him." He said, this is how you know that you know him. How is it? If you keep his commandments. Just as he did with Judas, when Judas said, how is it you're going to make yourself known to us, but not to the world? And he said, here's the one side, here's the other side. He does exactly the same thing in verses 3 and 4. He said, this is how you're going to know. Not think, not guess, not hope, not suppose. This is how you're going to know that you know him. If you keep his commandments. He said, the person who says, I know him and does not keep his commandments is a liar. And the truth is not in him. It is a very black and white, very binary equation. God says, you know me, or I will permit you to know me if you keep my commandments. He said, if you choose not to, you will not know me, and you cannot know me. I do literally have the power to make myself known and unknown. And you will know me based upon this equation. Simply stated, brethren, you cannot know God unless you keep his commandments. You and I are here for 8 days looking forward to the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of his kingdom on this earth. It's been true since the days of the apostles, 2,000 years ago. You know what? It wouldn't matter if Jesus Christ returned to this earth next year or whether he returned to this earth 2,000 more years from now. The element that I've just described to you will still be the defining factor when the millennium comes. In other words, how long it is between the time of Christ's first coming and his second coming affects not one iota the fact that the defining factor about whether you know or don't know God will still be the same. We were reading in Jeremiah chapter 31. Let's go back there. You know, Jeremiah said in verse 34, the day is coming where no one will ever again say, know the Lord. In my lifetime, I can't count the number of times, and I don't mean that because there have been an extraordinary number. I mean it because I've never kept track. But I know at least a couple of dozen times I've been stopped on a street corner in a city by somebody who simply asked the question, do you know the Lord? It was a lead-in question to an act of proselyting. I've been asked in conversation the same thing, again, a few times. Jeremiah said the day is coming where no one's going to ask that question anymore. And the reason they won't ask it is because there's no need to ask it. Everybody will. But Jeremiah also described why that would happen. Jeremiah 31 says, behold the days, Jeremiah 31 verse 31. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. What is the defining component to that covenant? I will put my laws in their minds, and I will write it in their hearts. What he says that follows literally follows, meaning it follows that I will be their God and they will be my people once what is previously stated happens. When I write it on their minds and I write it on their hearts, then by virtue of having written it on their minds and hearts, I will be their God and I will be their people. This is not a description of progressive events. This is a description of what happens subsequent to something else. When I have written it here and here, the effect of that is that I will be their God and they'll be my people. Nothing ever changes in this situation. It doesn't matter whether it's today. It doesn't matter whether it was when Judas, not Iscariot, was talking to Christ, or when the millennium begins. This is how one will come to know the Lord. Nothing changed. You cannot know God unless you keep His commandments. Whether today or in the millennium, everyone comes to God in the same way. And a yielded, obedient spirit is central to that relationship. If I walked through how each and every one of us came into this church, there is no difference in what took place here and here with what will take place with those who are the first generation of the millennium, the first generation of those who return from captivity. The physical circumstances are different, just the same as if I took at random a dozen people out of this hall, had you come up here and say, how is it that God brought you from someone who was indifferent, you know, ranging somewhere from indifferent to antagonistic to Him, to someone who loves Him? As you biographically walk through your life, 12 people from this room picked randomly would come at it from every direction. But the mechanics would be identical. Circumstances, different. Mechanics, identical. Everyone has to come to the place where they see a need for God in their life. If you don't see a need for God in your life, you're certainly not going to be looking for Him. There's a beautiful hymn that says, seek ye the Lord while He may be found. Call upon Him. God is not found by people who are not looking for Him. And people don't look unless they feel a need. If I go to those portions of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the minor prophets, and I read the scriptures about the captives of Israel returning from captivity, their need is so obvious it doesn't even need explanation. They are in such a state that if God does not deliver them, they will all die. And they know that. Seeing a need for God, they don't have any trouble seeing a need for God. They have been reduced to such pitiful circumstances that their life is a life of pleading and begging and praying that God will some way see fit to deliver them from their circumstances. You know, when you begin looking for God and you seek Him, in that process, there is also the need to, at some point, be convicted of the need to change. It's one thing to seek for God. It's another thing to find Him and have Him tell you that the hymn, "Just As I Am," is a big mistake. Now, He doesn't want any of us just as we are. He wants us convicted that how we are needs to radically change. Every single person who seeks after God must someday be convicted. On the great day of Pentecost, when 3,000 were baptized, those people were cut clear to the quick when the apostles said to them at the end of a sermon, as they progressively moved through their history, where they said to them in so many words, and I'm putting it in the modern vernacular, "Just a few weeks ago, whether you knew it or not, you killed God." And He so jolted them, they said, "What are we going to do?" For those who are returning from captivity, who are delivered out of their captivity, they have lived through the darkest hours of human history. God describes the end of the age in its darkest point as a time like has never been nor will ever be again. Conviction, that's not going to be a problem. When you're living a life, as prophecy says, where you wake up in the morning and wish you were dead, and you go to bed at night and are sad you're still alive, and you are so totally consumed with your anguish, conviction is not difficult. Conviction is easy. As a result of seeking God and being convicted of the fact that you are not worthy of Him and that His mercies need to be extended toward you, you have a person who is willing to consider the need to turn from the way that led to their problems and to seek God for solutions. Isaiah 55. Isaiah 55 gives us a little taste of this. Isaiah chapter 55 is pure millennial, meaning it is in its entire setting a chapter about the end of the age and the return of Christ and the state of man at that particular time. I'm going to read 4 verses to you, and I'm not going to read them necessarily in order, and as you will understand in a moment why. I'd like to read verses 8 and 9 first. Here's where Christ is explaining to those who are returning from captivity the reason why they don't know Him and why they have not had a relationship. And He said in verse 8, He said, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord." He says, our problem in knowing each other is you don't think like I think, and we don't walk the same way. He said, you need to understand. Your thoughts aren't my thoughts. Your ways aren't my ways. And He didn't say that mildly. Verse 9, He says, "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours and my thoughts than your thoughts." He said, it isn't just that we're just slightly out of sync. He said, we're on different planets. Now, this particular thought, you know, in a conversation when you're moving along and you say something and then you think and you retract and you restate some principles, that's what's happened in chapter 55. Verses 8 and 9 are somewhat of a recapitulation after verses 6 and 7. Verses 6 and 7 I referred to earlier. "Seek the Lord while He may be found. Call upon Him while He is near." Now, what do you have to do? Well, He said, "Let the wicked forsake his ways, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord." Okay. He says, look, for the individual whose way of life is not right with God, stop it. Let the wicked forsake his ways. Stop doing what you're doing. And for the unrighteous man, his thoughts. Stop thinking what you shouldn't be thinking. Get your mind out of the gutter. And get your actions in line. And he said, I'm more than happy to know you. Let the wicked forsake his ways. Let the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord. And what will happen? He will have mercy on him. And he will abundantly pardon. He said, I don't really care to be alienated from you. But if we're not on the same page, you don't know me. Stop doing what you shouldn't be doing and stop thinking what you shouldn't be thinking. And I'm more than happy to say, now let's build a relationship. At the beginning of the millennium, God is going to take an entire body of people that have been purposely worked with to the place where they can return from the north, from the south, and from the east, and converge upon the Holy Land and establish their residency to begin the physical restoration of the land of Israel. And they will be a people who are receptive, a people whose ears are open, a people whose hearts are malleable, a people with whom God will begin to build the relationship that will lead to the place eventually where no longer will anyone need to look at the other one and say, do you know the Lord? Because when he looks, he says, I know this person knows the Lord as well as I do. And that person knows the Lord as well as I do. I don't need to ask those things. When the millennium comes and the remnant of Israel are returned from captivity, God will have a people who have been humbled. They are a people who are contrite. They are a people who are repentant. They are a people who are willing to surrender their will to God's will. And they will become the first people of that age to come to truly know the Lord. Ezekiel 11 describes in a nutshell the process that the remnant of Israel will go through. Ezekiel 11 and verse 17, Therefore say, thus says the Lord God, I will gather you from the peoples, assemble you from the countries where you've been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they will go there, and they will take away all its detestable things and all its abominations from there. And then I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within them, and take the stony heart out of their flesh, and give them a heart of flesh. All of these are symbolic ways of saying the very things we've been talking about. I'll give them a heart that's different. I'll give them a new spirit. I'll take that resistant, stony, flinty, reluctant heart, and I'll by operation take it out and put in its place one that is warm, pliable, and receptive. Why am I going to do that? Verse 20, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my judgments and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Brethren, there are dozens of places throughout the prophecies that describe the manner in which God will work with these people to bring them to the place that they indeed will know God. It'll be a fabulous day. It'll be a day unlike anything this world has ever seen, and something that I know all of us are looking forward to. But I'd like to probe a little deeper. Because I began, as I said, with the book written by Bruce Barton and simply made the comment that in the 2,000 years between Christ's discussion with the leaders of his day and the writings of the early 20th century, that nothing had changed. That we live in a world that doesn't know God. That you and I worship the God that nobody knows. Why doesn't this age know Christ or the Father? I've given you the most significant component, but let's probe a little deeper. There's a clue in Matthew 24. I'd like you to turn to the Olivet Prophecy, Matthew 24, probably one of the better known chapters in the Bible for the audience here today. And I want you to read a verse with a different hat on. You know, you get into the rhythm of reading things with a certain mindset. And at times you need to back away and look at it a little differently. Here in Matthew 24, the disciples ask Christ, as all of us know. They said to him, "We want to know these things." They wanted to know, as they ask him privately, the signs of his return and of the end of the age. He said, please tell us the signs of the end of the age and of your return. If I ask you without peeking, what was the very first thing Christ said? How many of you know where the string begins? This is where Christ began his answer to their question. Verse 4. The Lord answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." You know what? I would say the majority of people probably read those two verses, verses 4 and 5, and they overlay on top of those two verses the sense that I must beware of and I must keep an eye out for false prophets. You can go further in Matthew 24, and it literally talks about the proliferation of false prophets. In fact, as you go further into Matthew 24, you get to the place that we were last night, where it talks about the power and the effect of those false prophets bringing the world to the place that the whole world would be deceived except for the very elect. But let's for the moment remove the overlay off of these two verses, the overlay of suspicion that this may be referring to false prophets, and simply look at it on the face of it all. He says, "Many will come in my name." Well, that indeed has happened. It has to be in the hundreds of thousands, if not in the low millions of individuals between the resurrection of Jesus Christ and today, who have gone forth in some fashion and in some way in the name of Christ. If I counted all the pastors, all the priests, all of the missionaries, all of the evangelists, all of the, you know, we just take categories, expand it out with all the terms you want. There have to have been hundreds of thousands of individuals who have gone forward to every corner of this world and internally within every nation in Christ's name. Now, he just simply says, "Many shall come in my name." All right? And what will they say? They will say, "I am the Christ." Now, you can read that two ways. The person who reads it, that many will come in my name, and the individual who comes in my name says of himself, "I am the Christ." Well, I don't think any of us have a problem saying that's a false prophet. Somebody comes and says, "Look at me, I'm Christ." Say, well, yeah, that's nonsense. But what do you do with a person who comes in the name of Christ and says that Christ is Christ? "Many will come in my name saying, 'I am the Christ.'" Let me teach you about Christ. This person isn't saying, I am. They're saying, let me teach you about. He is. I want you to know He is. Let me teach you about the fact that He is. We don't as commonly look at those verses in that fashion. If I look at the world that I live in, brethren, I look at a world where if I take this without the veneer of false prophet, I see simply what has indeed happened over 2,000 years. Hundreds of thousands of people have gone forward in the name of Christ and have proclaimed Him. Not usurped His name, not usurped His title, proclaimed Him. And the fruits of what they taught led people astray. Meaning the Christ that they came to make plain was in actual fact obscured by the proclamation. I have the privilege of having the Home Office send on a weekly basis emails that they receive from people who are writing to the Home Office in response to either the Good News Magazine, the World News and Prophecy, a booklet, the television program, the internet. And I get the opportunity to see their comments. And their comments are very interesting. In fact, in my office, I have a significant stack of their comments that I have printed out. And I see a particular type that I find fascinating. We wrote an article not too terribly long ago, and it's not an uncommon event, but we wrote an article not too terribly long ago about the issue of whether indeed there is an ever-burning hell or there isn't an ever-burning hell. This is one of those visceral kind of articles because people respond, and they respond with a certain amount of emotion. But what is interesting is to see the responses. And I have in my office two diametrically opposite kinds of responses to the same article. One says, how dare you go contrary to the Bible? You know, don't you know that sinners are going to burn forever in hell? That's what the Bible teaches. And how dare you teach contrary to that? Here's a person who has been taught about Christ. They've been taught about how He thinks, how He feels, what He believes, what He's going to do. And they have assumed that the Christ that they worship is going to implement this kind of place for incorrigible sinners. And therefore, our denouncing of it or denial of it or going through the scriptures that say it really isn't there is taken as an insult. Category one. Category two is the person that writes and says, those articles were absolutely fantastic. I sat down, I opened my Bible along with the article, and I went through the scriptures. Further, I went on from there to look even deeper into the Bible about this same topic, and I found that what you said is directly in line with, you have not misquoted, you have not distorted, you have not twisted scripture, you have enlightened me, and I am very unhappy with those who taught me previously what I have believed all my life. I've got both in my office. One, the first, is saying, I know Christ, and you are insulting Him. The other is saying, somebody came to me and told me about Him, And now that I've opened my Bible and begun to look, I'm finding out he's not who they said he was. Every single one of us is nothing more than a composite of what we believe and what we practice. Christ and the Father are no different. The centrality of the law is simply because the law is nothing more than a way of verbalizing or articulating this, if I can use a term, the soul of God. When people capsulize it and say God is love, that is simply putting in one very succinct term what it means to not steal from another human being, to not take away from somebody what belongs to them. Every one of you is attached in some way or fashion to the things you own. It hurts to have somebody come along and take away from you what you own. There is in the nature of a human being the desire to trust. And when somebody lies to you, they not only injure your relationship with them, they injure your relationship with everyone. Because you say, if they'll do that to me, then what about you? And you? Then you? All the commandments are is God's way of saying, here is how you love somebody. You don't do those things to them. And because I do love people, I don't do those things to them. You can't separate that and say, well, God is here and these things are there. No, they are God and God is them. If you pardon the grammar. I think every one of us gets upset with the perversions of Christ that modern writers dream up from wild imaginations, and every few years somebody's got to write a new book about Christ. In this last round, that Christ was nothing more than the result of an affair between Mary and a Roman soldier. You just think, how bizarre, how obscene, and how obnoxious can you get? But if I go back and I look at what's been written in the modern genre of trying to sell a book, bizarre pictures of Christ are fairly common in this modern time. The other side of it, brethren, is we have received letters of deep gratitude. I began as a sophomore in college, sitting in a cubicle in the male reading department. So that really means for 50 years in round terms, a little less than 50 years, about 46 or so, I have been exposed to the letters that come in from people who simply express a profound, deep gratitude for having helped them come to really see the true God and the real Jesus. To say, now I see him. Now I grasp him. Now I understand who he is. You're going to be instrumental in furthering that. Isaiah chapter 30. When you come to the front end of the millennium, you reach a point in time that is described in verse 20. Saying to these returning captives, though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be removed into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. There will be the opportunity to be taught. God will provide true teachers. Teachers whose words are verifiable. Whose advice, as the saying goes, can be taken to the bank. To a soft and pliable people of a willing heart, they will provide for them the mentoring and the teaching to truly build that bond with God. I want to take you one more step, because everything I've said to you so far in these two steps relate to either us as members of the Church of God, or they relate specifically to those people that are described in scriptures as those who are the descendants of Israel who will return from captivity. Realistically, we can become very myopic and very narrow in our view. I know enough of you have traveled that you've had a taste of the world outside of this continent and outside of this part of the world. And you realize and understand that this is speaking of a minority of humanity. This part of the population is only a fraction of the human population. The rest of humanity, which literally amounts to hundreds of millions of people, have never known God or Christ. And if you look at the world as a whole, the Orient, much of Africa, the subcontinent of Asia, you have billions of people who have never known God and in many cases have never wanted to. If I were to ask what is the most significant reason why billions of people have neither known God nor wanted to know God, I would describe the reason with one less than complimentary word. Hypocrisy. Ours, not theirs. Ours. If you look at the levels of hypocrisy that exist within the Christian world, and you stop and consider the effect that they have upon people who simply look at what they see and they measure it accordingly. One of the greatest reasons God is not known is because of the hypocrisy of those portions of the world who purport to know God. I grew up here in the Northwest. The states around Oregon are my home and birthplace. Idaho, Wyoming, Nevada, Washington, Oregon. I spent my youth in those areas. As a minister, once ordained, I was sent to a part of the country I'd never been to. I was sent to the very bottom of the Deep South. And it was interesting as a young man to watch the culture and to try to understand the culture of a part of the country I'd never been to. I found it fascinating that within the fabric of the humor of the South, from Brother Dave Garner, who was one of the leading comedians on the front end of my arrival, to Jerry Clower, who was one of the leading comedians on the back end of my stay in the Deep South, that all Southern comedians made great, great usage of humor related to hypocrisy in religion. And it was fascinating within the culture as I visited hundreds of families to find that one of the pieces of the fabric was it was a culture where there were many deeply, deeply religious and devout people. And there were also a reasonable number of skeptical, cynical people who, if you ask them, how did you arrive where you are? Their candid answer was, I arrived at where I was by watching the hypocrisy of those who said they represented God. And I thought it was an interesting thing to watch. Northern Europe is currently known, I believe, by a term, the Great Northern European Plain of Disbelief. If I were to take the history of religion in the latter part of Israel's history from the Old Testament, I would find there something that was typical of Europe between the time of the Reformation and modern times. And that was a state-run religion. It was interesting the number of times that God said to the prophets regarding the state prophets that they fundamentally were not prophets so much of God as they were functionaries of the state. For a person who understands European history, you can come to understand why it is that from an evangelical American Christian's perspective, Northern Europe today is a mission field. It is a place to go to convert people. And yet it was the birthplace of the Reformation. How do you move from the birthplace of the Reformation to a mission field? Generation after generation after generation of people being turned off on what they perceived to be God by a state religion that was more concerned with upholding the state than upholding God. You and I live in a Christian nation, one of many. There are Buddhist nations, Hindu nations, Islamic nations. Many of them, if you travel among them and you talk to the citizens, have no desire to be Christian. And if you, as I have talked to some of them and say, well, why? Explain to me where you are so I understand better how I proceed from where I am. We have a Christ who we purport to be the Prince of Peace. And the world around us looks at us and they say, what a dichotomy. Today the Western world is quite consumed with the issue of terrorism and of fundamentalist Islamic individuals who take the position that I need to do something that is physically destructive toward a Christian people, Christian nation, Christian area. We sit in a world where, if you look at it from outside, we have terrorized ourselves beyond the capacity of most outside to terrorize us. The French Wars of Religion, which were fought between 1562 and 1598, were wars that were fought between French Catholics and French Protestants. Because of the carnage and because of the lack of sophistication in statistics, the statistics are rather broad, but these Christian peoples were capable of killing between 2 and 4 million of themselves. As one Christian body prayed to God in their cathedral, the other prayed to God in their church, they then went out and slaughtered one another. The 30 Years' War was called the 30 Years' War because it lasted 30 years. For 30 years, Protestants and Catholics fought inside of Europe. Every Sunday going to church and worshiping the same God. And at the end of 30 years, they realized they had killed between 3 and 8 million of themselves, all in the name of God. World War I was probably the last great battle that was fought primarily between Christian nations. World War II, because of the Asian side and the European side, had a different character. But World War II was primarily fought inside a Christian theater by Christian professing nations. And at the end of World War I, Christians who prayed to God had killed 15.5 million of each other, and they had left 22 million of themselves permanently wounded. The nations that live outside of the Christian world look at us and they say, why would we want to know your God? God takes great umbrage. If you would turn back to Ezekiel chapter 36, one of the things that we often miss is that in coming to be known of all mankind, one thing God is going to have to do is to correct the image for all the rest of the world that has been created by those of us that claim to be Christian nations. In Ezekiel 36, beginning in verse 16, it says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, when the house of Israel dwelt in their own land, they defiled it by their own ways and deeds. To me, their way was like the uncleanness of a woman in her customary impurity. And therefore I poured out my fury on them for the blood they had shed on the land and for their idols with which they had defiled it. And I scattered them among the nations, and they were dispersed throughout the countries. I judged them according to their ways and their deeds. And when they came to the nations, wherever they went, they profaned my holy name when they said of them, These are the people of the Lord, and yet they've gone out of his land. But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations wherever they went. And therefore say to the house of Israel, Thus says the Lord God, I do not do this." Okay, he says, when I bring you back from captivity, "I do not do this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the nations wherever you went." Brethren, you could continue for the next 10 verses. In fact, I would advise on your own, read the next 10 verses, and God repeats this over and over and over. He says, "I am not returning you from captivity because of you." He said, "I'm returning you from captivity because of me." He said, "You've so damaged my name everywhere in the world, I have to repair it." Anyone who is familiar with Deuteronomy chapter 6, and I won't turn there. Deuteronomy chapter 4. In Deuteronomy 4, God makes a contract with ancient Israel, which he is going to see come to fulfillment in the lives of those who return from captivity. He said to them, "I'm going to give you my ways, my laws, and my statutes." And he says, "I don't want you to tamper with, touch, alter a single one of them." Now, that's what he said back to Israel in Deuteronomy. And he says, "I want you to go in the land, and I want you to keep my ways exactly as I've taught them." And he says, "Here's what's going to happen. All of the nations around you are going to look at you and say, who are these people who have God so near to them?" The sense of Deuteronomy 4, verses 1 through 8 is, I am so astonished by the modeling that I see that I'm compelled to go to these people and ask them about the God who gave them the standards that have provided for them the society that is so phenomenal. Well, Moses said to these people, rhetorically, before that book was ever over, "Oh, that there were such an heart in them," meaning this is never going to get off the ground. And it did never get off the ground, but it is going to get off the ground. Exactly what you read in Deuteronomy 4 will be the beginning of the millennium. If you take Ezekiel 36, where God says, "I'm bringing you back, not for your sakes, but because my name has been badly tarnished." And implicit in that is, you're going to be party to cleaning it up. Because you're going to come back, I'm going to take out that stony heart, I'm going to give you a new heart, I'm going to give you my spirit. You are going to live for the first time the way of life that I gave to ancient Israel. And you know what? All the nations around who have said, "I don't have any reason to want to know God," are going to study you, examine you, look at the fruits of your society and say, "I've got to know you. I have got to understand you." The scriptures we read about, "Come, let us go up to Jerusalem, to the house of the Lord, and we will be taught by him." The scriptures about 12 men will grab a hold of the skirt of a Jew and say, "Teach me about your God." Those are going to be the beginning of the millennium. God will use a people who didn't know him to become the teachers of those who never wanted to know him. Brethren, when all of this has taken place, when God has changed Israel's heart, When true teachers are installed for the good of man, and when the hypocrisy that has existed within the fabric of the Christian world has been replaced by genuine modeling of the ways of God, it will be at that time that the God nobody knows will become the God that everybody knows.